This book of Psalms again this evening, and our psalm tonight is this one that we read, Psalm 63. And verse 5 of this psalm begins, "My soul will be satisfied." But I don't think that should be translated as though the psalmist were talking about the future. The RSV is right to use, in fact, the present tense, "My soul is satisfied." That's what is really being said there at the start of verse 5. My soul is satisfied. And you don't need me to tell you then what the psalmist means by that. He doesn't mean that his soul is satisfied with Netflix. He doesn't mean that his soul is satisfied with Newcastle qualifying for the Champions League. He means his soul is satisfied with God. And what a thing that is to be able to say, isn't it? And my question this evening then is, how does one come to say that? I mean, say it truthfully. Anyone, of course, can utter the bare words, "My soul is satisfied with God." But how is one able to say that meaningfully? Of course, the most basic answer of all to that question is you have to be a Christian, fundamentally trusting Jesus Christ as your Savior and your Lord. That is the route to this kind of soul satisfaction. But many of you in this room, most of you in this room, are trusting in Jesus Christ. You are Christians. And yet it may be that some of you feel quite a long way away, really, in your Christian life tonight from Psalm 63, verse 5. If asked, how are you getting on right now? The first words to pop into your head would not be, "My soul is satisfied." So this is not just an evangelistic question that we're asking then. It's a question for us born-again folk. What does truthfully being able to say, "My soul is satisfied with God," involve? I have two answers, and we'll spend way longer, I'll warn you, way longer on the first than the second. So first of all then, it involves maintaining an appetite when your environment is debilitating. That's the first thing. It involves maintaining an appetite when your environment is debilitating. I want you to picture me one evening walking out of a restaurant in Newcastle. And I have a smile on my face and I'm saying to Hannah, that was lovely. I feel really full now," and other remarks like that. And you can tell then that the meal in that restaurant has really satisfied me. Now, from that scene of me walking out of the restaurant satisfied, you could easily work out what the scene had been like inside the restaurant over the past hour or whatever. You would know that I hadn't sat at that table uninterested in the meal, busy making phone calls or something and saying briskly to the waitress whenever she came over, "Oh, I'll just have anything, I'm not that hungry actually." No, you would know that I'd thought carefully about my choice from the menu, that while waiting for the food, I'd commented to Hannah on how great the smells were coming from the kitchen, that I'd exclaimed to the waitress as she set the meal in front of me, "That looks great," that I'd enthusiastically tried all the different side dishes. In a word, you would know that I'd had an appetite for that meal. I'd wanted it. I hadn't been distractedly and half-heartedly involved in it, because in that case, I wouldn't have come out at the end smiling and satisfied. Being satisfied with a meal presupposes an appetite that was there for the meal. That's what I'm saying. And the same applies then to being satisfied with God. It presupposes an appetite. The person who has little desire for that restaurant meal and takes little notice of it isn't going to derive great satisfaction from it. And similarly, the person who has little desire for God and takes little notice of him isn't going to derive great satisfaction from him. Now, on paper, it seems like pretty much a given that a Christian is going to have an appetite for God. Surely a Christian wanting God is like a tennis fan wanting Wimbledon, isn't it? Like a skier wanting snow. It's just natural and obvious and axiomatic. On paper, that's certainly true. But you know the old football adage. Someone will say, on paper, England should win this match easily. And someone else will reply, ah, but football isn't played on paper. In other words, you're right in theory about England, but in the hurly-burly of the actual football match, the theory may not translate into reality. And in the same way, then, that football isn't played on paper, the Christian life isn't lived on paper either. It's lived in this messy world full of problems and difficulties that can sap our appetite for God. So that while, yes, in theory, it's just a given that a Christian wants God, sadly, the theory may not always turn into reality. And it's this messy world full of problems and difficulties that I'm getting at in my heading then, with that phrase, when your environment is debilitating. You know what that's like, don't you? It might be your home environment, where finances are tight and life is just an unrelenting slog of school runs and night shifts, and there are often tensions and quarrels between family members. Or it might be your work environment, where you're surrounded by gossiping colleagues and the boss doesn't like you, and there's an ever-increasing mound of paperwork that you have to get through, and fresh rounds of redundancies are always looming. And those environments then, they're hardly calculated, are they, to energize our desires for God. They are debilitating. They leave us jaded and numb and disinclined to want God eagerly. But note what I'm saying in the heading then. I'm saying that if we are going to be people satisfied with God, as in verse 5, it involves maintaining an appetite when your environment is debilitating. That is, we mustn't give in to the numbness and the disinclination to want God eagerly. The desire for God must still be retained, though everything militates against retaining it. And this is where we must turn then to the beautiful example of this that's set forth for us here in this psalm. Now, there's a really crucial translation issue that I must point out in verse 1, which is this. That line, in a dry and weary land where there is no water, in the Hebrew text there is no as at the beginning of it. The as suggests that this whole dry and weary land thing is just a metaphor, an image that the psalmist is drawing on in order to capture a situation which actually isn't a dry and weary land at all. It's something else. But as I say, the as isn't there. The psalmist isn't being clever here and using a literary device. He's just straightforwardly stating his present circumstances. He's in a dry and weary land, simple as that. He's inhabiting some kind of desert landscape. The title, of course, fits with that, doesn't it? A psalm of David, it says, when he was in the wilderness of Judah. And that, then, is a debilitating environment. It's physically debilitating, with its extreme temperatures and dearth of life's basic necessities. It's mentally debilitating, having to be constantly in survival mode. It's emotionally debilitating, given that, as we'll see later, the only reason for loitering in the desert was presumably that enemies had driven the psalmist there. So the psalmist, I'm saying, is in a debilitating environment. Now, the psalm comprises three stanzas, the third slightly shorter than the other two. And the striking feature of the first stanza then, in verses 1 to 4, is this. The psalmist wanting God above the things you would expect him to want most in that debilitated environment. I'll say that again. He's wanting God above the things you would expect him to want most in that debilitating environment. Look at verse 1. He talks there about thirsting for and fainting for something. Now surely, just basic realism demands that for the time being, the thing he thirsts for and faints for has to be water. Everything else surely must be suspended. Water for a while has to occupy all of his desire. It has to be the one thing that he wants, surely. And I'm sure he does want water, desperately. He's no Superman. His body is wired the same way that everybody else's is. But remarkably, even in a dry and weary land where there is no water, he doesn't allow the desire for water to swallow up the desire for God. Even as he wants water, of course he does, even as he wants water so much, he still wants God. My soul thirsts for you, he says. My flesh faints for you. Or then look at verse 3. And surely then, inhabiting an environment that is literally deadly, where mortal dangers are everywhere, surely for the time being, the top priority has to be preserving his life. That has to occupy number one spot on his agenda. And I'm sure he does make preserving his life a priority. He has no intention to just curl up and die in that wilderness. I'm sure he does make it a priority, but he refuses to make it the priority. Enjoying God's steadfast love, his hesed, his reliable love, is that, he says, that's his top priority. Even when his life is threatened in all sorts of ways in that desert, enjoying God's love rather than preserving his life is top priority because, he says, God's love is better than life. God's love is better than life. So I hope you're getting the picture here. Actually, verse 2 really gets to the heart of things. And absolutely crucial to verse 2 is its opening word, so. Criminally, the NIV omits the opening word, so, at the beginning of verse 2 there. But even though our version does include it, we're accustomed these days, aren't we, to just about every other sentence beginning with the word so. It's a bit of a fad, and we're not inclined, therefore, to pay much attention, perhaps, to it. But this opening so here is significant. The Greek version of the Old Testament translates it there with a word which means thus. And that's good. The psalmist is saying to God here, in the way that I've just described, with my soul thirsting for you and my flesh fainting for you, thus I engaged with you in the past. In normal times, when I was living in my own house and able to visit the sanctuary, the tabernacle, with the same desire and appetite, thus I sought you then. Now, do you see the significance of that? The point is that from living normally and comfortably back then to now living in this parched and life-threatening desert, his appetite for God hasn't changed between the two settings. His circumstances have changed. They've changed beyond recognition. His appetite for God is the same. That's the significance of the thus. The same in the debilitating environment of verse 1 as it had been in the flourishing environment of verse 3. And isn't this challenging then? I mean, when you and I are in the kind of debilitating environment that I just talked about earlier on, whether it's at home or whether it's at work or possibly both indeed, when things are just so stressful and wearing, it just seems overwhelmingly reasonable and unavoidable that our attitude then must be, sorry, right now what my soul thirsts for has to be determined by these particular circumstances that I'm experiencing. It has to be a way through all these problems that are in my life right now. That has to be what my soul is thirsting for above all else. Anything else is unrealistic. Sorry, right now, meeting the mortgage payments has to be top priority. It has to trump all other ambitions in my life. Anything else, I'm afraid, is just unrealistic right now. I'm saying it's so easy, isn't it, to justify a temporary suspension of earnestly seeking God in our lives. Oh, that's for calmer periods. That's for more straightforward periods than this one that I'm in right now. This situation, I'm afraid, just isn't conducive to earnestly seeking God. It's too debilitating. And I'm saying then that if we think like that, we're not going to reach the heights of verse 5, my soul is satisfied with God. That's not going to happen. We need to have that thus of verse 2 at the heart of our Christian lives. Was there perhaps a golden era in your Christian life when your circumstances were wonderfully uncomplicated and your environment eminently suited to seeking after God? And you did seek after God and you had an appetite in those days. Well, the message of Psalm 63 is, as you sought God then, thus seek him now. Your circumstances, your environment have changed, but keep your appetite for God the same. Keep your appetite for God the same. It's interesting that a further aspect to this emerges in the second stanza in verses 5 to 8. Where not only does the psalmist maintain an appetite despite his debilitating environment, we even see him there, as it were, taking advantage of some of the debilitating things and kind of making them serve his appetite for God. So look at verse 6. And we talked a little bit about this verse last week. When I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. Now, we mustn't romanticize that verse. In the last analysis, of course, it's saying something beautiful. But in the first instance, actually, it's talking about a very unpleasant situation, namely the inability to sleep. You see, the point isn't that the psalmist has laid on his bed precisely in order to remember God. No, he's laid on his bed for exactly the same reason that anybody else lays on their bed to sleep. But he can't sleep. Derek Kidner comments on that phrase, the watches of the night there. He says, it's an expression which stresses the slow progress of the hours. Some of you perhaps know something of that. The hours of the night progressing very slowly as sleep eludes you. And the reason then he can't sleep is probably has to do with the environment that he's in. It could be that, because as I said, he's presumably in this desert as an exile on the run from enemies. It could be that his body is just too much on high alert to be able to sleep. Every noise that he hears sounds like someone's creeping up on him to get him. Or it could be the cold, which we know, don't we, in desert environments is a feature of the nighttime, the plummeting temperatures after the glaring heat of the day, the sudden freezing cold of the night. So you see, the sleeplessness is an aspect of his debilitating environment, and it could then just encourage a marginalization of God in his life, pushing God to the edges. My one all-consuming need right now is sleep. I've no time to think of God. And I'm saying it's not just that the psalmist then doesn't fall into that, but he even takes advantage of the sleeplessness and makes it serve his appetite for God. And he says, well, if I can't sleep, I'll employ the wakeful watches of the night in enjoying God, thinking about him, meditating, reflecting on him. We have a further example of this in verse 7. Apart from water, which we've mentioned there in verse 1, what is the other thing that you would be particularly desperate for in the wilderness? Well, shade. And the lack of shade then was another painful, difficult aspect of the psalmist's debilitating environment. But again, what we see him doing, I think, in verse 7 is actually taking advantage of that, exploiting it to push him toward God instead of away from God. And his mental process is something like this. Well, this thing that I conspicuously don't have right now, shade, in a deeper sense, it's reminding me that's exactly what I do have. Because where am I? I'm sheltered under the wings of God. By the way, the word shadow there, it's the same Hebrew word for shade. I wonder, actually, it's an interesting image, that, isn't it, of being under God's wings, and it obviously crops up lots of times in the Old Testament and perhaps has different nuances in different places. I wonder here whether there's almost a romantic nuance. Remember, I think Mike referred to this text fairly recently on a Wednesday night in the Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 3. We have the female voice there, the female character, saying, "As an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. With great delight, I sat in his shadow." And it's the idea then of this woman kind of reclining into the strong, manly frame of her lover, who kind of screens her and protects her from the sun and gives her shade. And it's intimacy then that is being pointed to. And I wonder whether there's that nuance here in our text. Because he then goes on to say, verse 8, "My soul clings to you." Douglas mentioned that word when he was speaking in Joshua a few weeks ago on a Wednesday, and it's the same word that we have in Genesis 2:24 about how the man will leave his father and mother and hold fast, I think the ESV has it, cling to his wife. It's romantic language. And the psalmist then is really here thinking of God as his lover. And I'm saying then, as shade is on his mind, and he could just think of his lack of it. Instead, he's turning that on his head and he's thinking of how, in a deeper sense, even in this wilderness, he is reclining against his divine lover and enjoying his protective shade stretching over him. So, I'm saying then this evening, don't let your debilitating environment, don't let your difficult circumstances, whatever form they may take, don't let them prevent you wanting God. That's what the psalmist won't let happen here. His circumstances are deeply difficult, deeply debilitating. He won't let them prevent him wanting God. He won't let them drain away his appetite. He maintains his appetite. Boy, he maintains it. And if we are going to be those then who really say, "My soul is satisfied," that involves maintaining an appetite when your environment is debilitating. But secondly, and much more briefly, it also involves something even more fundamental. It involves maintaining an assurance when your enemy is doubting. It involves maintaining an assurance when your enemy is doubting. So we've commented on the first two stanzas. In the last stanza, verses 9 to 11, the psalmist expresses his confidence that those who, as we've said, have presumably necessitated the exile, have driven him out into it, he expresses the confidence that they will receive their comeuppance. And most of it then is fairly self-explanatory, until you get to the last line, and that's somewhat surprising, where he describes these enemies who have driven him out into exile and who are going to receive their comeuppance. He describes them as liars. And you think, why liars? Thugs, yes, they've driven the psalmist out into exile. Bullies, yes. Pursuers, yes. There are lots of words that would seem to fit them, but why liars? Well, as you've heard me say in the past, it's there's a feature of Hebrew literature, which is this, a bracketing device, whereby in a passage, perhaps a poem, or it could be any kind of passage, there's a theme that's present both at the beginning and the end. It's like kind of enveloping, bracketing the whole thing. The writer will begin on this theme, and then he'll come back to it right at the end. And I think we have that here, because it's interesting how the psalm begins. You would have thought it might simply begin, "O God, earnestly I seek you," and so on. Because earnestly I seek you would seem a fitting first line, because that kind of captures what so much of the psalm is going to be saying. But he doesn't begin on that note. He begins instead, "O God, you are my God." That's the very first thing that he says. Perhaps because, in addition to seeking to destroy the psalmist's life, these enemies of his are also insinuating that God has rejected him. There's an episode in the life of David which makes that scenario quite plausible, I think. It's recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 26. On Wednesday we're in 1 Samuel 23, just 3 chapters later in 1 Samuel 26. The same thing is still going on. Saul is still pursuing David. And this is then one of those occasions, not the one we were looking at on Wednesday, but the next occasion when David kind of is able to creep up on Saul unawares. And this time the water jug and the spear are taken by David. And then, remember, David goes a little way off and shouts, "Saul, where's your water jug? Where's your spear?" And the conversation ensues between David and Saul. And this is what David says to Saul then in we'll read verse 19. He says, "Now therefore let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day, that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" That's quite interesting, isn't it? David is saying that those kind of Saul's associates who have driven him out into the wilderness, one of the things they are saying is, "Go serve other gods." In other words, you're not Yahweh's. Yahweh doesn't want you. You don't belong to him. It may be that that precise situation is the backdrop to Psalm 63, but even if it isn't, it shows that this was a kind of thing that could happen sometimes. And I think then that it may be in that sense that these enemies are liars, as the psalmist calls them there at the end of the psalm. They are liars in that they are insinuating, Yahweh's not interested in you. He doesn't want you. He's rejected you. And if the psalmist then lets that lie get under his skin, and if he lets that lie, "God has rejected you," take root in his thinking, then certainly he's never going to exclaim, "My soul is satisfied with God." Nothing is going to make that less likely than if he's no longer believing that God is his God. But you see, he doesn't let that lie get under his skin. He doesn't let the lie take root in his heart. He's emphatic at the very outset of the psalm, "Oh God, you are my God." No matter what they're saying, no matter what the liars are insinuating, no matter what the people who have driven me out into this desert are saying about your relationship with me, I know this is your relationship with me. You are my covenant God. And so, you see the significance of my heading. He maintains an assurance when his enemy is doubting. And you know, we have an enemy who is a liar. I'm talking about Satan. That's how Jesus describes him, isn't it? In John 8:44, he's a liar and the father of lies. When he lies, he speaks his native language, Jesus says. And he's a liar who, in particular, like these liars, likes to doubt, likes to cast doubt on the fact that God is our God, and that God loves us, and that God is for us. And he likes to do that. He likes to pour doubt on God's love for us, precisely because he doesn't want us to reach that point of verse 5 where we exclaim, my soul is satisfied with God. That's like filthy language in the devil's ears. If there's one sentence he hates people to say, it's, my soul is satisfied with God. That is the worst sentence he ever wants to hear. And Satan then will use things to try and make us doubt that God wants us and loves us and is for us. Two things in particular. He will use our sin, and he will point to that. And he will say, look at you. Look at your behavior. Look at what you're like. God's not interested in you. He doesn't want you. He doesn't bother with scum like you. He will use our sin. And then the other thing he will use is our suffering. And he'll say, well, how can God possibly love you if he's put this in your life? If he sent this circumstance, this situation, he can't possibly have any desire for you if he sent that across your path. And we need to be able to answer the liar then. We need to be able to answer those doubts. We need to be able to say in the first place, Satan, far from disowning me because of my sin, God has actually sent his own son to a cross to deal with my sin and to make my sin a non-issue in his sight. And Satan, secondly, far from putting suffering in my path because he has rejected me, Satan does it actually, as David Mathers reminded us last week, because he loves me. And he wants to refine me and make me better and fashion me and shape me through this suffering. We need to be able to say, in the face of all the doubts that the great liar throws up, we need to be able to say, oh God, you are my God. Whatever he says, you are my God. Because only on that basis, only on the basis that we can say, oh God, you are my God, will we go on to say, my soul is satisfied with God. If we can't say the first, we won't say the second. If we're doubting that God loves us, we're not going to be satisfied with him. We're not going to be saying, your love is better than life, if we're not sure that that love even exists for us. We must be assured. And to be assured, we must fight the devil who will try to make us unassured. And one more thing in that connection. And with this I close. Look forward, believer, to that day when verse 11 will come true, even with respect to the liar par excellence. His mouth will be stopped. His mouth will be stopped. One day you will enjoy God in a Satanless world, where no question mark will ever again be placed alongside you and your status and your relationship with God. Sin will have gone. Suffering will have gone. And the one who loves to exploit them both will have gone. The liar's mouth will have been stopped. Isn't that an encouraging prospect? As day after day we battle against this liar insinuating repeatedly, God doesn't love you. And we fight those insinuations, but as we do so, we look forward to the day when he will insinuate no more, when he will be silenced, when his voice will not be heard from the bottom of the lake of fire, and we will be free with doubts, done with doubts, and forever and ever we will enjoy our God without anyone pouring cold water on that enjoyment. So, believer, aspire to Psalm 63, verse 5. Aspire to having that as your testimony, written large across your life, my soul is satisfied with God. But that will involve then maintaining an appetite when your environment is debilitating. And more fundamentally still, it will involve maintaining an assurance when your enemy is doubting. Amen.